It's time now for Bucks Blue with your host, Lower Makefield Chief of Police, Joe Kelly, brought to you by Jammer Doors.
And welcome to Bucks Blue. This month, Stephen, a few changes, right? We have this month on Bucks Blue.
That's right.
We have a new theme song. Only 3.5 or 4 years to get Bucks Blue to have a prominent police-themed theme show.
That's right. We got a whole overhaul for you.
And a new police department.
Right? Roll out the red carpet.
Well, I appreciate that. Today we have on a guest. We're going to continue where we picked up a few months ago when we had our co-responder, Taylor Zarco, on with another mental health professional, someone who deals with mental health all the time. And this is so important because police officers over the last few decades have become challenged in a way that we have never been challenged before in terms of mental health. There's less facilities open, residential facilities, than there was when I started. There seems to be more and more challenges with people who are presenting with mental health difficulties. So without ado, I present this month's guest, a police psychologist who, when I was in Yardley Borough until just a few weeks ago, serviced the borough as our primary psychologist, Dr. Elizabeth Johnson. Welcome, Dr. Johnson.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And let's go a little over your education and how, but we'll start even way before that. Tell me about the day when you knew that you wanted to be a psychologist.
I know it was sometime in high school.
Okay.
I remember taking a psychology class in high school and being fascinated. I had a very quirky teacher, and it was thoroughly interesting. And then somewhere in there, I was just really captivated by, I would say, like, people who engage in aberrant behavior, so okay. violent behavior. And so then, you know, like most people who fall into forensic psychology, I fell down the serial killer rabbit hole, and then started, once I had the opportunity to tailor my education to it, I did.
So let's go off on a tangent for a second before we review some of your education, because you mentioned something there that prompted a memory. In my teaching at Bucks County Community College, in my intro class, I require every student to make a presentation to their classmates on something in the criminal justice field. And I cannot tell you how abnormally popular serial killers are with college students. What is the fascination with serial killers? I'll get 7 out of 10 that are on that exact topic.
Wow. Honestly, I think it's trying to understand how people end up engaging in this behavior that it seems so horrifying, terrible, and the way they perceive the world and the way they perceive people is just so far outside the norm. It becomes very, you can be curious about it.
So education. You grew up in this area, right?
Yeah, actually I grew up in Yardley.
No kidding.
Yardville.
Okay.
I forgot already.
That's not Yardley. You're going to offend some
Yardville.
Of our listeners here.
I'm sorry. Yardville. I'm going to keep doing that in New Jersey, in Hamilton.
And you attended, I think your poster for your high school is right outside here in the
yes,
studio, right?
Yes, I'm very excited to see it. Yeah. Hamilton High School West.
And then after that, you went to Seton Hill University.
Correct. Nice correction.
Well, I'm not going to mistake those two schools. You know why that is, Stephen, right?
No.
I'm a graduate of the Seton Hall University,
okay.
The prestigious Seton Hall University.
The prestigious.
And that's in central Pennsylvania?
It's a little closer to the west side, okay. So closer to Pittsburgh.
And your undergraduate degree is in psychology, I presume?
Yeah, with a minor in, I think I hit the full minor for criminal justice and philosophy.
Yeah. Oh, just those two things. Okay.
Yeah.
And then graduate school, you went to the Chicago School of Professional Psychology.
Yes, yes.
That's a mouthful.
It is. And also fantastic school in downtown Chicago. And literally, this happens every school I go to. Right after I graduate, they open an entire forensic unit. So all students have their own clinic who are studying forensics to go into.
And then I'm not going to take a stab at where you received your doctorate. So maybe you could share with our listeners.
Yes, I got my doctorate at Carlos Albizu University in Miami. It used to be known as the Miami School of Professional Psychology.
Okay. And then you started practicing psychology thereafter in Florida.
Yes, yes. So I have my doctorate in, I have what's called a PsyD as opposed to a PhD, which means that I started providing services essentially my second semester in school. So I've been providing services for a very long time under supervision before graduating.
And then you, I mean, this is where, it because not that the studies weren't interesting, I'm sure, but you develop a fascination for forensic psychology.
Yeah, I got to dive into it. I got to start doing my dive in my bachelor's program.
Okay.
So I did, my internship was actually at Westmoreland County Jail. So I got to be with the psychology department there for a year. And then my master's is in forensic psychology. And there, I actually, my internship at the master's level was actually with the probation unit, the intensive sex offender unit for Cook County Probation. So I got to act as a probation officer for about a year.
So if you could just and you elaborate a little bit with our listeners on what forensic psychology actually focuses on.
Yeah, so forensic psychology is really any intersection between mental health and the law. So a forensic psychologist could be providing court-ordered treatment. They could be doing evaluations for the courts. They can be doing evaluations that are court-ordered, or they can be asking specific legal or answering specific psycholegal questions. So if someone says, I'm not competent to proceed, right, or if they claim insanity, sometimes the court will ask for a mental health evaluation or a violence or sexual risk assessment. It's really any time those two things come together.
And I know we spoke about this offline, and it kind of fascinates me, but the average psychologist dealing with the lay patient, I would call it for lack of a better term, has an uphill climb to recovery, right? I mean, the treatment is complicated. How much more difficult is that when your patient is ordered to sit in front of you? And how do you overcome that? I guess it's two parts.
Yeah, so I provided court-ordered treatment for quite some time.
Okay.
And I was providing services to... for a little bit, I did some juvenile work with juveniles who were part of a diversion program because they had engaged in problematic sexual behavior or actual sexual offenses.
Okay.
And then I did quite a bit of that work with adults, adult men who had engaged in domestic violence and were legally involved because of that, or parents who had child protective services involved and were ordered to participate in treatment or to be evaluated. Or
either
both.
Way, though, you're starting in a hands arms folded position, right?
You know, I don't know that I would say that.
Okay. That's interesting. Tell me more.
Yeah, so when someone comes in off the street and says, I want therapy.
Okay.
They're going off of their own motivation, right? And as someone who now provides treatment to the general public, I can tell you there are a lot of people who come in for therapy who really want someone to talk to.
Okay.
Who aren't necessarily ready for the change that they came in for. Right. Versus someone who's court ordered to see you, they have to see you for the very specific thing that brought them into court, right? Or got, you know, law enforcement involved in some capacity. And, you know, authentically, they're in a pressure cooker, right? There is something on the line for them, right? Whether that's their freedom, their ability to have contact with minors, family members, be reunified with their children, right? They have a different reason to be motivated.
Okay. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah. And sometimes that means you've got to work through that because they're coming in and they're presenting like, I'm ready, and they're not.
they're
trying to snow you a little bit, right? Just trying to do what is necessary to get to that end goal. But how you overcome that, I think as a clinician, you have to be very good at developing a positive relationship, seeing the person beyond whatever the criminal activity is, right, that brought them to you. You have to have a lot of empathy and be open in showing that. And then you have to balance that with, I'm still going to hold you accountable. We're still going to really talk about why you're here, what the decisions were that led to that, and how to move beyond this.
And I don't think that's much different than, I mean, there's some crossover there into policing as well. Mm-hmm. Some of the best investigators I have ever seen, some of the best detectives, are the ones that are, in those preliminary minutes of the interview,
yes,
are extremely patient, they are extremely measured, and they keep the topic and conversation away from the crime that we're going to talk about. And they develop through emotional intelligence that you're mentioning, right? That empathy, even if it's not well placed, the common ground that may be between the detective and the suspect, and you develop that relationship, and then everything seems to flow from there. So it sounds like there's some crossover there.
Certainly, and actually, funny you mentioned crossover, because we'll use some of the same techniques when I do evaluations. So my evaluations, I have very lengthy clinical interviews before we do the psychological testing, or before I even discuss why they're in front of me. Why did the judge want them to meet here, right? What behavior are they demonstrating that's causing concern, et cetera? That is the last topic that we address, because I spent the rest of that time really developing a relationship and taking the time to understand that person's perspective, so that when we get to the more loaded topics, we have enough of a relationship developed where I can ask you really hard questions that maybe nobody's asked you thus far, or maybe the judge wants to know the answer to, or, you know, law enforcement, like we've broke, that's how you, we call it breaking denial when working with people who've engaged in sexual crimes, right? And you can do it through straight empathy and developing the relationship, and then eventually you can ask the hard questions and they'll start to answer.
Outstanding. Stephen, why don't we take a break here? When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Elizabeth Johnson.
Insurance can be very confusing and costly. That's why it's very important to choose the right insurance agency. Nottingham Insurance in Yardley and Hamilton is a fourth-generation family-owned insurance agency with over 100 years of experience. They'll find the best policy for maximum protection at the best price. Homeowners, business, life, auto, even flood insurance. Peter Toft at Nottingham Insurance will make getting your policies, including flood insurance, an easy and affordable process. Nottingham Insurance in Yardley and Hamilton. Visit nottinghaminsurance.com or call Peter Toft directly at 215-493-1996, extension 214. That's 215-493-1996. Extension 214. Capital Health's primary care network continues to grow, bringing its extensive option of locations to your neighborhood. Whether you're scheduling a wellness checkup or not feeling well, advanced medicine starts with a Capital Health primary care doctor at locations near you in Mercer, Bucks, and Burlington counties. To find a Capital Health primary care location that's convenient for you, visit capitalmedicalgroup.org. That's capitalmedicalgroup.org.
I'm Henry Carpenter, certified elder law attorney and host of Senior Legal Strategies right here on WBCB. On a recent Senior Legal Strategies, we discussed the importance of the four basic estate planning documents. A general durable power of attorney names someone to take care of your finances, properties, and legal affairs if you can't. A medical power of attorney names someone to make lifetime medical care decisions if you can't. A living will or health care directive sets forth your directions for end-of-life care. A last will and testament directs where your assets go and don't go after your death, and selects someone to finalize your affairs. I invite you to call us today at 215-493-0727 to schedule a no-cost consultation to discuss these documents and any other concerns you may have.
We now return to Bucks Blue with Lower Makefield Police Chief Joe Kelly, brought to you by Jammer Doors.
And welcome back to Bucks Blue, our April 2025 segment. And we are in studio with Dr. Elizabeth Johnson, a forensic psychologist, not a police psychologist, as I misspoke before. And Doc, before we went, we were talking a little bit about forensic psychology and how effective you can be with someone who is forced into help. Let's talk a little bit more about some of the things that you do on a daily basis. So you've had experience now with both the general population and with people who are compelled to be there through criminality in some way, shape, or form. What's the biggest difference between the criminal mind and the mind of someone who is coming to see you in general therapy? And we touched a little bit on this already.
Well, it's a tough question.
That's why I'm not answering.
Well, and you might be surprised by my initial response. aside from a very small subset of people who are criminally involved,
okay,
there isn't much of a difference. I would say that we're still dealing with, you know, trauma histories. We're still dealing with mood disorders. We're mm-hmm. still dealing with people who perceive the world a certain way and are trying to navigate it based upon that information and past experiences. And that's just not working for them, right? And I think it just might show up a little more exaggerated,
okay,
perhaps, right, with someone who's more criminally involved versus someone coming in off the street. There have been some very interesting studies applying the ACEs, the Adverse Childhood Experiences. So it's a really neat and growing body of research where they came up with these 10 items that actually started coming from a pediatrician, started to notice some things amongst children,
okay,
who were having anxiety, and some parents are coming in with ADHD or my kid's belly hurts and they don't want to do X, and slowly realizing that these were children who had a lot of stressors,
okay,
that they were experiencing. And we now can predict all kinds of things with this information, and you can Google ACEs. I think it might be even ACES.org or something like that.
Okay.
I think the sample size is over 20,000 people at this point, and they can predict if you have a score of 3 or more, you are going to have a higher likelihood of substance abuse, mental illness, criminal involvement, heart attacks, hypertension, etc. You can go down the list, right, in adulthood. And so we've started to apply that more in the forensic world, to say, okay, let's acknowledge that this is a thing that's happening for a lot of people and it influences their behavior when they're adults. And we're seeing high rates of ACEs for people who are criminally involved.
So let's take an offshoot of that for a second. What happened to our childhood? You know, I don't want to sound like that older guy, but life was a little bit simpler, you know, prior to the cell phone, prior to the computer.
Yeah.
We went to school, we came home, we played, did a little homework, and that was our day. How much of what we are asking our children to do may be compounding some of these issues that may have laid below the surface a generation ago?
Man, super complicated. I will do my best to simplify this, acknowledging that I'm not a child psychologist,
right, right,
but I have provided treatment to juveniles who are criminally involved, and I also have provided evaluations for the courts for children who are criminally involved, and those are psychosexual risk assessments, mental health assessments, etc. So, sorry, I'm smiling because I'm like, oh, this is a deep dive. If we really wanted it to be, really, there's a, I think people are starting to recognize it. That Netflix documentary that came out.
On The Social Dilemma?
Yes, thank you. Yeah. The Social Dilemma, I think, was fantastic. And there's so much psychology in it. It's disturbing to watch the psychology.
It was tough to watch.
Yes.
You know, even excluding the science. It really was.
Yeah. I think I watched it in 15-minute chunks because it was like, that was so much information. I need to go digest that. 2 days mm-hmm. later, come back, watch another 15. That was the longest, actually, I think it's taken me to watch a documentary. But really, we are messing with our brains. And there's been some pretty staggering research that shows that our social network has really fallen apart, and the internet is now this mediator for our social networks. There was one study that found that, like, 14-year-old girls, they prefer likes on Facebook to their posts to someone coming up to them in person and saying, hey, I like your outfit, or what you said was really cool today. And the fact that it's not producing the same response in the body of connection, you know, to have that in the moment together is very, it's super disruptive. So what we're really doing is we've disrupted our ability to connect to each other. And I think that is probably one of the main underlying issues, because we're also not regulating our body. And what I mean by that is, you know, when you get that dopamine hit, that little bit of joy from that like, or mm-hmm. Candy Crush. I remember when Candy Crush like first came out, not completely date myself, but start heading in that direction. And we're getting that constantly. We're getting these things that visually, auditorily stimulate the brain and leave us wanting more. We're getting addicted to them because they're literally using the psychological science of addiction to push it. Gambling is built into all of these things. So what we have are brains that are not designed to withstand stress. We don't have enough opportunities to experience success despite struggle, right? And we're eroding our ability to connect to each other, which is one of the primary ways that we receive support and feel safe. So literally at the physiological level, we are making it harder for ourselves.
And like to that end, there are protections in place for selling of tobacco products to a child. There are protections in place to allow a child under a certain age to gamble or to ingest alcohol. But there seems to be no protections against any of these other addictive behaviors.
Well, I mean, when television first came out, there weren't any protections against that either.
With 2, 4, and 7, I don't know what you were going to, how much trouble you were going to get into, right?
Well, right, but we can acknowledge that television is also a form of media that has been misused, right?
Correct.
Where, so I would say that it really comes down to, just like with TV, that we had to figure it out and then get some motivation to decide to put some parameters in place around that. There's a book called The Anxious Generation that is really excellent for parents who are trying to figure out, how do I help my child, right? And also, why would I even need to do this, right? What is happening? Why is this valuable?
Okay.
Is it impacting society? How is it impacting us individually? And then what is a parent? What are some strategies that I can employ?
Excellent. So getting back to criminality and the intersection of psychology and criminality, a lot of people don't realize, and I'm going to use very, very rough numbers here, putting on my criminal justice instructor hat, but there are approximately 8 million people incarcerated in the entire world. There are approximately 2 million people incarcerated in the United States of America alone. So the most technologically advanced, the most democratic society has 1 out of every 4 people in jail inside our country. How much of that do you attribute to any type of either mental disease or inability to control inhibitions?
I don't know if the listeners could hear that sigh.
I did all the way over here, so I'm sure it came through the microphone.
To be honest, I'm not going to say that I have the answer, right? We have people studying this up and down and left and right, trying to
but
figure out.
But it is something hot in your area of expert, in your occupation.
Yes, okay. Yes. And social justice is a huge movement. And because of kind of where my work takes me, I tend not to be looking at it from that perspective. I'm very much focused on the individual as opposed
good,
to
good.
The,
yeah.
the systemic piece of it. I have to say this, consequences are not the solution. I'm not saying do away with, the criminal justice system or do away with the prison system or anything along those lines. I think it's one of the basic things we have to acknowledge is that consequences are not the deterrent that we wish them to be, right? People do these things knowing that they're against the law.
Mm-hmm.
And I can say this, I have met, and since the pandemic, I think this is also an important thing to note, the pandemic was extremely destabilizing, particularly for the youth. I sound so old when I say it like that, but the number of children that I, or teenagers, like young teenagers, that I assessed during the pandemic and afterwards, you can see struggle, 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 and then watch everything completely fall apart during the pandemic. And I think that we really should be acknowledging just sort of the rise of violence in society and normalization of these things is really impacting those kids who maybe are more vulnerable. And once someone gets into that system, it can be pretty hard for them to get out. And I don't mean because, they're labeled or, I just mean, I've talked to kids who literally don't know how to get out. Right. And because they have so many external stressors happening and they're in survival mode so much, I can come in, I can offer solutions. Someone can come in well-meaning and say, here's some emotional regulation skills. Let me help you develop your frontal lobe in a way that you're not prepared to, right, because of your age and your physiological development. But I'm going to help you think through the consequences. And then we put them right back in the same environment. It's like adults don't withstand that. right? How are we expecting children to?
You're absolutely correct. So tell me what frustrates you most about the criminal justice system when it intersects with mental health. And while you're pondering that, I just want to follow up a little bit on what you said a second ago. I couldn't agree with you more that deterrence just doesn't work in this country, and that the only way to reduce this prison population is through prescriptive measures, meaning we need to find the underlying cause on what put someone into jail and then change that underlying cause so that when we put most of the people that go to prison eventually get returned to the streets. And if we don't make some type of substantive change while they're inside, we're not going to get any results. So sometimes that's substance abuse. Sometimes that's mental illness. Sometimes that's economic issues. But we have to address each person as an individual and not a one-size-fits-all.
Right. And then I think it becomes this unfair burden on the system, too, because then the system becomes responsible for trying to solve all of those things. Right. Because for most people, it's a combination of factors. Right. And so then the system is burdened with trying to resolve all of those things. Mm-hmm. And that's just not possible. And I think that that's the hard part that a lot of people who want to do major reform are sort of saying, let's do. At least there seems to some voices have shifted. And it seems to be let's do a major overhaul. And I'm like, well, what you're asking of the system is someone who dabbled near it. Right. Mm-hmm. Or in it. That's a lot to be asking of a system to sort of like almost single-handedly restructure society, right, and fill all of the gaps in all of these ways.
Let's take another break here. When we come back, let's continue our conversation. And for our listeners, Stephen, we're going to get into some issues regarding first responders and psychology when we return.
Capital Health's primary care network continues to grow, bringing its extensive option of locations to your neighborhood. Whether you're scheduling a wellness checkup or not feeling well, advanced medicine starts with a Capital Health primary care doctor at locations near you in Mercer, Bucks, and Burlington counties. To find a Capital Health primary care location that's convenient for you, visit capitalmedicalgroup.org. That's capitalmedicalgroup.org.
Insurance can be very confusing and costly. That's why it's very important to choose the right insurance agency. Nottingham Insurance in Yardley and Hamilton is a fourth-generation family-owned insurance agency with over 100 years of experience. They'll find the best policy for maximum protection at the best price. Homeowners, business, life, auto, even flood insurance. Peter Toft at Nottingham Insurance will make getting your policies, including flood insurance, an easy and affordable process. Nottingham Insurance in Yardley and Hamilton. Visit nottinghaminsurance.com or call Peter Toft directly at 215-493-1996, extension 214. That's 215-493-1996. Extension 214.
If you recognize my voice, you know about my music. What you may not know is since I founded it in 1992, the Elton John AIDS Foundation has reached over 100 million people. We've saved over 5 million lives. We've helped combat LGBTQ+ stigma and fought for civil rights. We need you to help end the AIDS epidemic once and for all. Learn about how you can help at eltonjohnaidsfoundation.org and follow us at EJAF on Instagram to see our very latest accomplishments through the Rocket Fund.
We now return to Bucks Blue with Lower Makefield Police Chief Joe Kelly, brought to you by Jammer Doors.
And welcome back to Bucks Blue, April 2025, in studio WBCB, 1490 AM, 107.3 FM, and of course you can stream anywhere in the world via the internet. Stephen, I forgot to put out our taglines before, but we got it at 133, so we're good. So we're in studio with our guest, Dr. Elizabeth Johnson, a local psychologist. And before we went to break, we were talking a little bit about criminality and psychology. But I want to shift gears into something that's near and dear to my heart, which is some of the psychological challenges that come with choosing a life as a first responder. Specifically for me, policing. I've had the benefit of seeing some of the most renowned police psychologists available to do training, and the first hour when they present to us, it's not a happy one, right? They tell us about the statistics involved in police officers, and where the average life expectancy is 74 to 76 years old in the United States, the average police officer will only live 66. I don't know why we don't have that on our recruiting brochures. Come join our ranks and give up a decade, right? 83% of law enforcement officers in studies have shown have 4 to 6 hours of sleep a night, which is considered a disorder.
Yes.
When we are sleep deprived, we're 6 times more likely to make judgment errors.
Yeah.
In our mature years, our midlife years, we're more likely to gain weight in our midsection due to the response to our stress and adrenaline. And the list goes on and on and on. So that's the bad news. The good news is if you practice good mental health, you take some of the recommendations that are made by known psychologists, and you make that part of your everyday life, you can really combat a lot of these barriers. So why is policing and first response so dangerous when it comes to mental health?
Because it's so dangerous.
Okay, tell me more.
Right, it's very dangerous, extremely stressful. People are put in situations where they're either, directly witnessing trauma. They might be experiencing it themselves, either primary or secondary exposure. And then you have them in naturally, right? They're going out to a call. They don't know what it's going to be. People don't call the cops because they're happy, right?
I always say that. No one picks up the phone in the morning and says, I'm having a great day. It's sunny out. The birds are chirping. Let me call the police.
Let me just let you know. I wanted to share that with you, right? And so they're going into situations where that they know are going to be tense, high stress, and have demands of them. And often they're in the position of needing to de-escalate and calm people who themselves are in having a very strong stress response, right?
Okay.
Feeling threatened in a variety of ways, whether it's because I feel threatened because the police are here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm calling the police because I felt threatened in some capacity, right? So I think there just really isn't there's some resistance to acknowledging the level of chronic stress exposure that people in first responding positions have.
And some studies have said that, and some will word it in different ways, but that the average police officer will see more human suffering in the first 2.5 years of their job that the average person will see in their entire life.
Yeah.
So what's your advice to young officers on how to channelize that? I mean, I'm the father of a young police officer who has gone through those first years of experiences and has come back to me and said, what's your advice on this? What's your advice on that? And I found myself saying, how did I deal with that at that stage? But is the way I dealt with it correct? So you never, it becomes difficult. So what would be your advice be to young police officers, young firefighters, to a lesser extent, and EMS workers who see this type of suffering and trauma?
Yeah, I think first, let's just acknowledge, let's pretend, not pretend that this doesn't exist.
Okay.
Let's also acknowledge that this naturally has an impact, and it's normal. It's healthy for it to have an impact, right? It means that we're emotionally available. We're showing up fully present. We're trying really hard to have an we're internally motivated to be here. This matters, right?
Okay.
I'm doing this because it matters to me. Therefore, it's going to have an impact. Right. So I think first it's let's say that it's probably good that I am not dead into this and I'm having a response. Right. It means I'm a healthy human who's motivated for the right reasons here. And then I think the other part is enhancing the quality of your life. Right. It's not about, the psychologist said do this and that immediately colors it a certain way. Really, all we're ever saying is, hey, we want you to live a better life. One that feels really good for you, right? That is nourishing in some way, that reduces stress, that gives you the opportunity to let go of what was happening and also not have it bleed into your personal life. And I don't mean compartmentalize because there are limits to that.
Correct.
That's not the most sophisticated coping response. Yeah, it's have really good friendships outside of work. Have things have meaning for you outside of your job. Have a sense of mastery outside of your job. Have real relationships. Lots of use of humor. So much humor. Humor is very important for resilience, and that's really what we want to be building, right? It's about being able to resist and tolerate the stress, which means really building a quality of life.
And you mentioned so many things there, and I want to explore a few of them. One of the things that makes a police officer's job unique is that hypervigilance, right?
Yes.
We go to work, we're normal people, we try to be living healthy lives, and then we have to shift gears. And we use roll call as that formal place where we transition from being, in our off-duty role to our duty role, where we set that hypervigilance, because we work in a position that we don't work on possibilities. We don't work on probabilities. We work on possibilities.
Yeah.
Every other job, you can calculate danger through what's possible, what's probable, but we do it on what's possible, right? So then we have to turn off that hypervigilance at the end of the tour, and that's where some of these issues become involved. So you do resonate when you say we need those off-duty relationships. I found in my personal experience that having friends and trusted friends who are not police officers has helped a great deal.
Yeah, and the thing, and there's actually overlap here with forensic psychology, because we are also really, I'm working with some people who've done some pretty bad things, and then I might be responsible for them, right? I'm part of providing treatment as we try to reintegrate them successfully in the community, and that doesn't go well. I've had that experience quite a few times. And so there's this real need to have people who don't look at the world the same way that you do.
Okay.
Because I need someone to remind me it's not as dangerous as my experiences, because I've got all the experiences that tell me the world is very dangerous. I've got all the research, I've got the stats, and I've got the professional experience, just like a police officer. Well, not just like, but, similarly.
And very comparable. You're seeing behind the curtain.
Right, right. So. Yeah, and because of the work, we're seeing a very specific slice of life,
right?
And so we need people to remind us that that's not necessarily the entire picture of reality. We also need people to keep us in check for the things that we naturally do to compensate for that hypervigilance, to maintain a sense of safety once we leave work, right? We need people to remind us that maybe that's not the way the average citizen goes about that, right? And those become checks to say, how much is my job impacting me?
Okay.
Right? And do I trust the other people enough? And hopefully we have those people.
Suicides in policing.
Yeah.
A big, big problem. It's one we don't talk about. We almost never talk about them. But the average loss of police officers is somewhere between 100 and 150 each year in the line of duty, carrying out what their duties are. The estimate on suicides are 2 to 3 times that number, 300 to 450 to up to 600. And again, they're estimates because there's no accurate data on that, probably because police officers investigate police officer suicide.
Hmm.
We have made in this business great strides towards overcoming stigma in mental health. When I came on in the early 1990s, we didn't talk about these things.
Yeah.
We didn't discuss these things.
Right.
We didn't suggest these things. They were just things we didn't speak about. Now there are several groups out there where we can get peer counseling. We can offer services, and officers are looking for services, which is the greatest news in the world to me. So what do you think changed that allowed police officers to lose some of that bravado, I would say, and say, this is good?
I don't know. I feel like that's a question actually for you, right?
Yeah,
like,
what's
evolved, right, in that community, in your community, to make this more normalized, right? For this to be something that we're going to invest in each other in this different way,
And, right. and I would suggest to you that we're members of, not only are we members of our subculture, but we're a member of the larger culture. So maybe as this became more commonplace to ask for help, that it became more commonplace with us as well.
Yeah, yeah. And I would be very curious to know how those numbers changed after the pandemic, because I know in the mental health field, we saw this complete shift during the pandemic. Everyone needed a therapist immediately, all of a sudden. Right. Then there were really tough shortages. It's one of the reasons why I actually left my last job during the pandemic and transitioned back into providing treatment, was because of the things that were coming up and the need was so great. And now it's much more common to see a TikTok or, an Instagram post or anything just saying, yeah, go to your therapist. Of course. Of course, everyone has a therapist, right? And so we've seen that. I'd be very curious to see if that shift is, again, since the pandemic, if we've seen it also support that rise with the law enforcement community.
Because in addition to the stressors that police officers have at work, they have those same normal stressors that yeah. everyone else you see does, right?
Yes.
We lose family.
Yes.
We go through a economic crisis is in our homes. We go through divorce.
Right.
All of the same things that are presenting to the general population gets exacerbated upon that, plus all the human suffering and stress right. in this occupation. So when we come back, I want to talk more about that, because I want your advice on what else we can do in policing to make sure that our people are taken care of.
Okay.
Capital Health's primary care network continues to grow, bringing its extensive option of locations to your neighborhood. Whether you're scheduling a wellness checkup or not feeling well, advanced medicine starts with a Capital Health primary care doctor at locations near you in Mercer, Bucks, and Burlington counties. To find a Capital Health primary care location that's convenient for you, visit capitalmedicalgroup.org. That's capitalmedicalgroup.org.
Insurance can be very confusing and costly. That's why it's very important to choose the right insurance agency. Nottingham Insurance in Yardley and Hamilton is a fourth-generation family-owned insurance agency with over 100 years of experience. They'll find the best policy for maximum protection at the best price. Homeowners, business, life, auto, even flood insurance. Peter Toft at Nottingham Insurance will make getting your policies, including flood insurance, an easy and affordable process. Nottingham Insurance in Yardley and Hamilton. Visit nottinghaminsurance.com or call Peter Toft directly at 215-493-1996, extension 214. That's 215-493-1996. Extension 214.
If you recognize my voice, you know about my music. What you may not know is since I founded it in 1992, the Elton John AIDS Foundation has reached over 100 million people. We've saved over 5 million lives. We've helped combat LGBTQ+ stigma and fought for civil rights. We need you to help end the AIDS epidemic once and for all. Learn about how you can help at eltonjohnaidsfoundation.org and follow us at EJAF on Instagram to see our very latest accomplishments through the Rocket Fund.
We now return to Bucks Blue with Lower Makefield Police Chief Joe Kelly, brought to you by Jammer Doors.
And welcome back to Bucks Blue, April 2025, WBCB, 1490 AM, 107.3 FM. And we're in studio with our guest, Dr. Elizabeth Johnson. And we're talking, before we went to break, about some of the psychological challenges in law enforcement. And one of the things we were just starting to scratch the surface on is the change in acceptance of how therapeutic not only self-help, but professional help could be to first responders who are in need, and that shift in philosophy. So I'd like to continue to explore that. But when we talk about self-help, let's just shift gears there for a minute. Part of your mental wellness deals with part of – it intersects with physical wellness, and they cannot be separated. I know you've done a lot of work in that area. Can you comment how important – your body wellness is to your mental wellness?
Absolutely. And I do want to clarify, too, because when we think about body wellness, we think about, oh, what is your weight? Are you exercising? Mm-hmm. Right? What is the food that you're taking in? And of course, those are important things.
Okay.
Right? From the mental health perspective, I'm also looking at it from how good are you at reminding your body that you feel safe? Which goes back to that hypervigilance that you had mentioned, right? That in first responding naturally, because of the circumstances, you have an increased rate of hypervigilance. And long-term effects, you had earlier said, right, the suicide rates, gaining weight in certain ways, substance use, et cetera, those are all effects because our body is sort of in this alerted state.
Okay.
And so after work, I think it's critical, either after, before, both, right, going to bed, before you walk in the door to see your family, taking some time to soothe the body. And one of the most basic ways of doing that is diaphragmatic breathing, which in the American culture, we seem to like lose shortly. It's at some point during childhood, this innate ability to breathe from our belly or from our diaphragm. But that is very important for soothing the vagus nerve. So if your listeners are interested, I really encourage them to get some information about the vagus nerve and to be curious about that, because really exercise, singing, deep breathing, certain types of movement, linking movement and breath, which happens.
I just want to let you know now, if I start singing at home, that's going to create a whole other host of problems.
So maybe that happens in the car before you go inside, right?
Yeah. That's going to cause other problems.
But these are all things that we can do for just a few minutes, right? Or maybe naturally build into the rest of our day as we're doing something that are going to soothe the body. And that's critical that we spend more time there. And the science of it is absolutely fascinating.
So I think policing's made some strides in understanding we need to take care of our people.
Yeah.
The average police budget is approximately 90% labor, meaning we're spending $9 out of every $10 on our people.
Yeah.
We need to take care of those people. 30 years ago, when I became a police officer, the schedules were four days on, 2 days off, rotating backwards. You never had a weekend off. Mm-hmm. There was no real quality of life for a young police officer. And you were told, you'll get your turn someday. Sit there and don't say anything.
Right.
We've made strides away from that, right? The schedules have improved. The acknowledgement that our people are important has improved. But is there anything else that the 17,000 police chiefs that are listening, in addition to me, can do to make sure that our people are taken care of?
There are a lot of things. I think I would recommend, really, there are a number of resources that exist. So in preparation for this, I couldn't help it. I had done a little bit of research. I know you said don't do it, but I did. The Department of Justice actually put out and I think it's May 2023, they actually put out a whole process of or things that can be implemented at the organizational level.
Okay.
Right? And then down to improve officer wellness. Right. So I highly recommend, again, quick Google search. We'll do that.
Right. Yep.
The Office of the Victims of Crime also has trauma-informed toolkits. They're all pre-made. Again, they're at the organizational level. You can find it specific for officers. You can find it for EMS. You can find it for firefighters. It's all right there.
Okay.
It's focusing on how do we empower the staff? How do we, when I say the staff, I mean, of course, officers and their supporting staff. How do we link them to services? How do we find qualified professionals? How do we change the culture? Right. And the little ways of doing it. And actually, you mentioned the scheduling. Scheduling was actually one of the things that they listed that they needed to shift the scheduling so that the officers had the opportunity to engage in essentially what I would consider protective behaviors before coming into work, whether that's going to the gym, going golfing with some buddies, something that is nourishing, restores before you go back into the setting, right, that is stressful, as well as making sure that you have that time away from the setting to decompress and reconnect. So there is a lot out there. I can share that This is also prominent in the forensic field.
Okay.
You know, I started off in the correctional setting, right, where it's the same thing. You are stoic. You are unperturbed by anything. You do not mention what, if anything, causes you distress. And actually, in the correctional setting, psychologists actually have the role of essentially PO or COs as well. So when an alarm goes off, they're running straight towards the situation.
Okay.
They also have to do firearms certification every year, you know, et cetera. I lived that experience also in providing community-based services that were forensically oriented. And it has been amazing to see the shift when I've worked at places who are different. And the shift is we talk about it. We acknowledge that this is an issue. It is normalized, and then support is provided, whether that's in the moment, saying I've been there too, or if it's suggesting something else, and really infusing wellness into the culture.
One of the shifts that was made a couple of, it might be more than a couple of years now, it might be a decade or a decade and a half ago, was that in response to a traumatic event, a shooting, an officer-involved shooting, death of a child, something that was really traumatic, it used to be the officer's discretion as to whether or not to seek help.
Hmm.
Most departments now have it by mandated by policy that you go and you get it. And I think that small shift, right? It was a small policy shift, but now the officer can, if he is concerned about the way he appears to his peers, he or she can say, I'm going because I've obligated to, but may still get something very therapeutic out of it. When I had my my significant incident a few years ago, we did a department-wide hot wash, and I thought that was extremely therapeutic, where everyone got into the room and shared some of the things that they were feeling. And I think everyone, or pretty close to everyone, left with a better understanding of the thoughts they were having and the things they were dealing with. Why are those group sessions so therapeutic?
Well, it goes back to what I've mentioned a couple of times here, connection, right? I'm not alone in this. I'm not the only person feeling this. This is a shared experience, right? And it removes the stigma, or I should say reduces, right?
Mm-hmm.
Reduces
Absolutely.
The stigma around it. And so then it becomes, it's okay now that I'm experiencing this as well, right? The people around me are, this is normal. And I don't have any, I can work through maybe those extra thoughts about what it might mean, right? Then I am, of course, having this experience.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's so crucially important. Let's talk about some of the, because we're into our last couple of minutes, some of the programs that are out there right now for first responders. We have Valor, which is a federal program nationwide. Want to talk a little bit about what they do?
Well, I looked them up. actually, I was very impressed because, you know, I have to say, these programs are out there, at least at the, I almost describe it as academic, right, when we get it, when we talk about it at this level, but at least the information is out there and someone is willing to notice and provide money something up. So if you're curious, it's there and someone else has already put together a wonderful couple of paragraphs to explain exactly why this is necessary and the impact on police officers who do receive these services and the ones who don't. And so Valor connects them to services, right? And I think it also offers a number of trainings, too, to help departments as well. Yeah.
And then there's some more on the local level. We serve here at WBCB, we serve Bucks and Philadelphia. Bucks, Montgomery, and Philadelphia. And on the New York side, I'm sorry, New Jersey side. I don't know where New York have New Jersey side, probably because all the Giant fans are in New Jersey. Right, Stephen?
That's right.
We serve Burlington and Mercer. So on the Bucks side, we have the Bucks County First Responder Peer Support Group, which is a 24/7 peer support, which will help first responders, police, fire, emergency workers, and their loved ones with family issues, job stress, financial concerns, any type of substance abuse. It's 100% confidential, and it's done through peer support. And if your issue is more than the peer support can handle, you will receive referrals And the nice one about the Bucks County program is you can refer a coworker, you can refer your family, you can refer your friend. And for anyone out there who may be in need of these resources, you can contact 267-893-5200 if you're a police officer or a loved one of a police officer. And if you are a first responder, 267-893-5400. And if you're on the New Jersey side, they have a great longstanding program called Cop to Cop, which is run by the family of a police officer, a psychologist who's a family of a police officer. And they provide 24-hour peer support as well. And their phone number is 1-866-COP, the number 2, and then COP. 1-866-COP, the number 2, and then COP. And the Cop to Cop did some training when I was still a police officer in New Jersey. They put out informational videos. And one of the things they say about suicide is it's a permanent solution to a temporary problem.
Yes.
And I think they couldn't describe it better.
Right.
These things are so avoidable, so tragic. If you are out there and you are listening right now, I would encourage you, first responder or not, to seek help from someone. Go to a family member, go to a friend, go to a police station, go to a psychologist, but see someone and get some help. With that, Doc, we're wrapping up, so I want to thank you for coming on to Bucks Blue in our April 2025 segment. And next we will have Yardley Borough on air with Yardley Borough Mayor Chris Harding.